Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Meet the Professor. It's the day we talk about the management of chronic myeloid leukemia with Dr. Dan DeAngelo from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. We have a great faculty for this series, and later on as we go through the program, we'll show you the results of a survey we did of the faculty of their usual treatment patterns in CML. If you have any questions or cases you'd like to hear discussed, just put them into the chat room, and we'll talk about as many of these as we have time today. If you're into audio programs, and we know lots of people end up listening to these webinars in their car or working out, check out our Oncology Today podcast series, including a recent program with Dr. Bose on key presentations from ASH in MPNs. We do webinars all the time. Next Tuesday, we'll be working with Dr. Liu talking about targeted therapy of non-small cell lung cancer beyond EGFR. And then on Thursday, we'll be working with Dr. Kelly talking about all the new developments in hepatobiliary cancer, new options for first-line therapy of HCC, and biliary tract cancer since the recent GI symposium. On Wednesday, August the 3rd, we'll be working with Professor Lederman talking about the management of ovarian cancer, PARP inhibitors, et cetera. And then on Saturday, August 6th, another one of our all-day spectaculars. I'm actually heading out to Las Vegas myself. We're going to try a new approach to a day-long multi-tumor meeting because I'll be live, but the entire faculty will be virtual. I'll be there with the American Oncology Network docs. It should be a lot of fun. If you're available on the 6th, jump on a plane and head out to Vegas to join us. And on Thursday, August 11th, we'll be working with Dr. Sands talking about small cell cancer. But today we're here to talk about CML. And as always, we have a bunch of cases that we're going to present and get some feedback on. Here's where we're heading. We're going to begin chatting a little bit about kind of a broad overview of CML. Then I want to get Dr. DeAngelo's take on the onasimenib and particularly the first-line study that we talked about in our first program with Dr. Cortez. And then we're going to jump into some cases. So, Dan, I want to just start out and put these pictures up. These are two of the figures I think about when I think of targeted therapy of solid tumors. You know, I think when CML first started to break out and the imatinib was improved about 20 years ago, the solid tumor docs were also trying to follow the same model. Tom, I know you work with Tom at MGH, and we worked with him 2004 when he's the team there discovered the EGFR mutation in non-small cell lung cancer. Of course, now targeted therapy has evolved. Dr. Slaman, of course, a pioneer in terms of anti-HER therapy and trastuzumab. And I just want to start out with, you know, the hope, Dan, was that solid tumors were going to follow the model of CML, you know, targeted therapy. But, you know, as we get into this conference today and talk about particularly how we monitor disease, it's just a completely different ballgame. And I'm just wondering whether you think solid tumors are ever going to get there in terms of this model, or there's just something inherent about solid tumors that you just can't do the same approach. Any thoughts?
Yeah, no, I have some thoughts. I mean, first of all, I mean, I think, you know, when Brian Drucker presented the idea of targeted therapy for a blood disorder, you know, he was laughed at least initially. And I don't think people really appreciated the fact that if you can negate the driver of a particular disorder, such as the BCR-ABL in CML, that it was going to have this this efficacy or long-standing efficacy. And the fear was that you're going to have a cliff effect, that patients were going to do well for a period of time, and then all of a sudden, you know, you would breed resistance, and then, you know, the patient would recur and relapse. And that does happen, but it doesn't happen as much as you would think. And I think the difference, apropos what you just asked, between solid tumor and CML specifically, which is different from all other blood disorders, is that no matter what stage or phase of CML, whether it's chronic phase, accelerated phase, or blast phase, whether it's de novo or resistant refractory, the BCR-ABL is always the driver. Now, there may be other helpers along the way that may help with resistance, but targeting BCR-ABL always helps. And this is the theme of CML, that, you know, that there may be developed resistance to a particular drug, but the pathway for BCR-ABL driving the disease is always intact. And that differentiates CML from other diseases, specifically solid tumors. And I think that in itself is the key point. And the second key point goes back to the old Delbruck and Lurie back in the lambda phase. So I'm dating myself back in molecular biology in the 1930s, when you know imatinib is not does not generate mutations in the genome. That there are those of us who are or patients who are diagnosed with CML, they have resistance mutations there or they don't. And what you're doing is you're selecting for that resistant mutation. So patients are going to develop resistance within the first 6 to 12 or 18 months, or they're not. So there is no cliff effect that was that Dr. Drucker had feared early on. And so that's why patients do so well so long, is you're either going to select for the resistant mutation early on or that it doesn't exist. And that patients are going to do well, assuming they take their medications for a very long time. And those are the two facts that differentiate genetically between CML, always driven by BCR-ABL, and the other blood cancers or solid tumors that you discussed.
So one other point I want to bring up in this introduction also, you know, we a lot of times bring up papers that are written that would be take much too much time to go into, and this that we would refer people to check out. And I thought this is a fascinating, particularly for people interested in translational biology, paper that you did looking at MPNs in general in terms of molecular genetics. And there was a bunch of things in there that were interesting as it relates to CML. This graphic in particular, I thought would be helpful maybe for you to go through before we get started on the cases.
Yeah, no, I think this is a very important, and I think folks have seen variations of this particular picture, this inverted pyramid, the idea that you have a large bulk of disease in an acute leukemia or chronic leukemia. This is chronic leukemia here. You know, it's probably the largest tumor burden. We talk about 1 to 2 centimeter tumors in breast cancer, lung cancer, that may be about 1 billion cells. Here we're looking at 10 to the 12, 10 to the 13 cells. And what you're able to do at that red line, where patients can have a 2-log kill going down to about 1 billion cells, which is a large tumor. But if you dilute it in the 12 liters of, you know, marrow that I have, you're not going to be able to just see it cytogenetically. And that's the bar where patients are essentially cured. They're in this chronic disorder. The deeper in the well, the smaller the pyramid, this inverted pyramid that one can go, opens up other options in terms of being undetectable by modern technology and maybe perhaps coming off therapy. When we started this in 1998, 1999, it was always imatinib for life, dasatinib for life. And we weren't hitting the leukemia stem cell, but we're seeing with these were phenomenal results that we may have been wrong back then. And in fact, 20 to 30% of patients can successfully maybe even come off therapy. Whether that should be the goal of therapy, though, is a question.
So again, I really recommend this paper. There's a lot of great stuff in there, or some stuff in CHIP that we're not going to get into in detail, but really, really interesting stuff. One other thing I want to ask you about, I think I mentioned that the first program in the series with Dr. Cortez, and he's the PI on the Ask For First study that I was shocked that exists when I found that out they were even doing this study. And I just want to get your take because, you know, I could understand maybe Dr. Cortez a little maybe over-enthusiastic. So I want to get a balanced approach, but I thought it was super exciting. Even the mechanism of this drug, I think, is really interesting. So first of all, maybe you can just comment on that.
Yeah, no, I think that's the most important thing, right? So imatinib is an ATP mimetic, so it inhibits the binding of ATP to the kinase, the kinase domain. And there are resistance mutations that can make imatinib inability to bind to ABL and therefore block its ability to dysregulate or block BCR-ABL activity. And so all of the approved TKIs, dasatinib, nilotinib, bosutinib, ponatinib, are all ATP mimetic agents. And what they are is they're targeting the enzyme, so to speak, but they all have these off-target effects. And that's where the toxicities come between different patients and efficacies, depending on some of the mutations within the ATP domain. Well, asciminib is a completely different mechanism of action, which is very important because there are patients who will go from one drug to the other drug to the other drug and have some degree of intolerance and or resistance. But asciminib is an allosteric inhibitor. It works at a different site. There's a myristylation site that is removed when you have this reciprocal translocation with BCR-ABL. But the binding site still stays on ABL. And what asciminib does is it binds to that and effectively shuts down ABL. And it doesn't seem to bind other kinases. So if you talk about a magic bullet, we talk about targeted therapy, and we're fooling ourselves because there's about 80 to 90 tyrosine kinases in the human kindrome, if you will. And all of these drugs that we have approved hit a number of them in, differently. But asciminib really only affects the ABL protein, and therefore it directly inactivates ABL. And patients who are having toxicity issues with some of the other ATP mimetic agents, this may abrogate that. Patients who are having resistance issues, this may abrogate that. And so it really offers a different mechanism. And the other thing that I'll add on is that although there's no studies out there that are mature, it does have the ability to be combined with some of our other agents.
So hopefully people can hear me, although there's a little disturbance there in the video. But I wanted to ask you, of course, asciminib was approved last fall by the FDA in a relapsed disease. I want to ask you about these data presented at ASH, the ASCEMBL study, phase 3 trial, comparing it to bosutinib in third line and later. Any thoughts about the study? It looked like it was a better effect. Of course, it was third line. Any thoughts about this trial, both efficacy as well as tolerability?
Yeah, I don't think this study was a surprise that it was successful. You know, just to remind you, asciminib was tested in a phase 1 study in patients with chronic phase, accelerated phase. It doesn't seem to have the same efficacy in patients with advanced phase disease. It is also effective, importantly, in T315I. What is also known is that patients who are resistant or intolerant to a second-generation TKI, when they go to another second-generation TKI, the activity is a little bit less. And so this study was looking at third line. So patients had to fail two prior tyrosine kinase inhibitors. And so which means they would have seen a second generation. And this was comparing asciminib, the new drug, to bosutinib, which is another very fine second line drug. All patients with T315I were excluded because bosutinib has no activity against that. And as you can see here from these graphs, that asciminib was more potent than the second generation of bosutinib in this third line setting in terms of efficacy, not only in terms of rapidity, getting patients into remission very quickly. You can see here the 24-week and the 48-week data, but also maintaining them in terms of their level of response. And what I'm sure you're going to show later was not only was it more efficacious, it was also better tolerated. So this was a win-win-win for the patient in terms of third-line therapy.
What's your personal experience with the agent, particularly in terms of tolerability?
Yeah, as I mentioned before, I have collected a number of patients who have toggled between a variety of kinase inhibitors and have had some traumatic toxicities, you know, realizing that most patients tolerate these drugs very well, but there are those few patients that just simply do not. And when they hit asciminib or when they finally go on asciminib, they really have had no toxicity. There doesn't seem to be that overlapping issue with all of the ATP mimetic agents versus asciminib. It really brings a different game to the table. And this is much better tolerated in general for most patients. So, and it's a different mechanism of action, different tolerability, different adverse event profile. So it really provides the patient with yet another option that's very different from the other options that are available to them currently.
So this was the real shocker to me that this trial was actually, when I just saw the design, I was like, wow, that is interesting. First line trial comparing asciminib to investigator choice of first line therapy. Just any thoughts about this? I mean, I guess it's possible that all this debate we've been having the last few years about optimal first-line therapy maybe is going to get funneled into one direction. Any thoughts about any predictions, any comments?
Yeah, no, I think it's going to be very interesting. It's a large study. It's investigator's choice, which is probably the right way to do it. So you're not going to pigeonhole the investigator in terms of picking an agent, either first or second generation. It allows some variability because of patient comorbidities. One agent may be a little bit different than the other. There seem to be that those limitations with asciminib. You know, the endpoint here is going to be, you know, the achievement of a major molecular response, which is the gold standard for which all the other second generation and third generation agents have been approved. It may or may not be better. Hopefully it is. The question is, will it improve survival? I think it'll improve tolerability. And really the endpoint is, will more patients be able to come off therapy? That's not the primary endpoint of the study. It's exciting to have another game in the on the table to try and benefit patients. More options patients have, the more options they have, and the better they are. This is why CML is a very different disease now than it was when I was in medical school in the 80s.
Yeah, particularly if it ends up with more, as you mentioned, discontinuation, that would be awesome. We're going to talk a little bit about that moving forward. Also, I mean, we could spend a long time talking about some of the financial issues in oncology, but if this is positive, it'll be interesting to see how it fleshes or how people think it through financially, particularly if and when or the second generation drugs become generic. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, no, I think that's a very important point. You know, generic imatinib, you know, is an important player. About half the patients are receive that up front. The cost to the insurer is markedly reduced. The cost to the patient sometimes is not. That's the counterintuitive approach with American medicine, because the copay things are just not present. You know, as the second generations move into the generic platform, I think, you know, the whole cost of taking care of a patient with CML is going to decrease from the insurer's pockets. How much of that's going to be put on the individuals is unclear. This would represent, you know, a more costly approach to the insurer. And, you know, it really, in my opinion, it really has to be substantially better before I would move in that direction. I mean,
well, actually, when you
functionally, CML is essentially, you know, for most patients, CML is a curative disease. That is, they're not, you're unlikely to die of CML, whether you can come off therapy or not. And I think that's a very important point. Patients today are living as close to their age-matched cohort controls that they are. So there doesn't seem to be that decrement in terms of survival that it was back in the 80s and 90s.
You know, actually, I was just thinking about the fact that, you know, in a way, if it leads to more discontinuation, maybe it'll work out positively in terms of finances because you stop the drug.
Oh, that's an interesting point. And you know, one of the other options would be to combine some of these drugs together to have a intensive therapy and then stop. And here you're showing that study design. And that may be, you know, if you can have a year of expensive therapy, but then you're done, you know, because, you know, monitoring patients and giving prescriptions, that's where the cost comes in. These are all interesting financial things, way above my intellect to try and sort out the mathematics of some of these algorithms. But these are all very interesting options for our patients. But it is true that when I see a patient with CML, you know, by and large, I know that this patient is going to do well. My job as the physician is to try and find the best drug that matches the patient so that the patient can tolerate it.
And I'm particularly curious, you know, here's a trial looking at these a bunch of combinations that you were talking about. And I guess that when you think about it, it is, you know, sort of a different target on the same, you know, molecule. So it kind of makes sense. Any thoughts about which one of these combinations makes the most sense?
Yeah.
Or so they all look the same.
So the first thing I want to draw your attention to is the primary endpoint is this MR4 versus MR4.5. Those are the hallmarks for discontinuation. With the first line therapy, the hallmark or the primary endpoint was MR3, MMR, which is kind of the gold standard. So this is looking at the ability to be able to discontinue patients. The second question, of course, was whether you can or can't. You know, what's the, you know, all of these are ATP mimetic agents, and a lot of them have to do with, do they interact with the drug? Do they, and you can see some of the dosing issues here because of drug-drug interactions, the asciminib dose is a little bit different.
Right.
And then the combination of toxicities dependent upon that. I don't really have a feeling whether or not one is going to be better. I do like the idea of a once daily dosing regimen. I think that's likely to be more tolerable in terms of compliance. So, you know, the dasatinib asciminib or the imatinib asciminib, those are the ones that pique my interest, because I know I can't take a drug twice a day. I tend to fall off. But when I can do so, I can usually do something once a day. And I think that just makes it a lot easier for the patient and his or her family.
Yeah, I was thinking about those combination antihypertensive pills they have. Maybe someday we'll have a combination CML pill. Who knows?
Well, anyhow, yeah, you mentioned daily dosing. It lends itself to that. It sure does.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. So you mentioned the issue of dose, and maybe you can kind of straighten that out a little bit, and particularly in terms of what, you know, right now it's being used in the relapse setting. Can you talk a little bit about what we know, what we need to know more about in terms of dosing?
Yeah, so the dosing that was studied in the phase one study was a twice daily dosing, and the maximum tolerated dose for the non-T315I was the 40 milligrams twice a day. There was a subsequent parallel study looking at PKs that showed that 80 milligrams once a day was equally, had the same PK profile as 40 milligrams twice a day. And so both of those dosing regimens were FDA approved. I still use 40 milligrams twice a day because that's what I have done with all of the studies. A lot of my colleagues will go to 80 milligrams once a day. The important thing is that's not the dose that inhibits the T315I. It's the dose that inhibits all but. And for the T315I, even though you're binding at a distance, this allosteric inhibition, there is some conformational change with the T315I that requires a higher dosing of asciminib to inhibit that. And so it's at 200 milligrams twice a day. Currently, the 40 milligram tablet is being supplied. So that's, you know, five tabs twice a day. But it doesn't seem to increase the side effect profile. But it's important to notice and note that it's a different dosing schedule with the T315I.
All right. Well, let's make some rounds. We got some great cases here. I'm going to start out with this 61-year-old woman, a patient of Dr. Grunwald. Here's the case.
61-year-old female with a history of stage 1A hormone receptor positive breast cancer, currently on adjuvant tamoxifen. Bone marrow examination revealed chronic phase CML, BCR-ABL, PCR was 148%. On ultrasound, the patient had a spleen that was mildly enlarged at 14.5 centimeters in craniocaudal dimension. A couple of questions that come to mind with this patient. Number one, how can this newly diagnosed patient be risk stratified, and how can we use that information to guide our treatment decisions? And two, what initial treatment options are available for this type of patient? We went through the options with her. We had the conversation about first and second generation because she's intermediate risk by Sokol index, and also because I think we have a general preference for second generation TKIs over first, just deeper remissions, faster remissions. We went with dasatinib, and this patient is responding and meeting the milestones for response.
So any comments?
No, this is a very typical case. I think the issues that are brought up is, you know, the staging system or scoring system. You know, Dr. Sokol derived this staging system to look at life expectancy, survival, and this was in the pre-interferon era. This is an old staging system. The interesting thing is it also predicted survival in the interferon era. It predicted survival in the transplant era. It does not, however, predict survival in the TKI era. But what it does do is it predicts response. And so intermediate or higher Sokol score tends to respond better to second generation tyrosine kinase inhibitors than low risk Sokol score. So I use the Sokol score to risk stratify my patients. The one caveat I would caution folks is age plays a big role in the Sokol score determination. So this woman is intermediate risk, but it may be worthwhile to also calculate the UTO score, which does not have an age factor in it, to see what the response rate is expected with imatinib therapy. In my opinion, imatinib or dasatinib are very reasonable options. I probably wouldn't be using the other agents because of the tamoxifen risk of thrombosis with nilotinib issue. But I think risk stratification is important. As a consultative hematologist, I always require my my fellows to calculate out the Sokol, the Hasford, and the UTO score, just to give some prognostication, and it helps us judge which of the TKIs are appropriate. Again, the higher risk, you really want to move with the second generation. The lower risk, I think it's options for the patient.
So we have this concept of what we call going beyond the guidelines, because the guidelines often provide a whole bunch of options. But we like to ask people, well, what do you usually do? Because we know that's what all the docs are asking you. And you can see there's a real consensus here. Just kidding. So we say low risk. You and Dr. Morrow say imatinib. We say high risk. Again, a consensus. Just kidding. Actually, three of you say dasatinib. That's the closest we got. Any thoughts selecting first line therapy?
Right, but there is consensus here. There's 100% consensus is that we would not choose imatinib.
Right. Right. That's a good
point. And so the differences here are in comfort and then really looking at patient issue. I would be reluctant to use nilotinib because of the thrombosis risk. And I'm always worried about the liver function abnormalities with bosutinib because this person's on tamoxifen. And I don't want to jeopardize the tamoxifen issue but there's a lot of different options. There's no right option. There's no wrong option for the patient. These are just choices.
Well, that's what people like to hear about. And here's another issue we get a lot of questions about. You know, it's really amazing sitting down and talking to general medical oncologists about CML because, I mean, it's an uncommon disease, but they have plenty of patients in their practice because, you know, the prevalence is so high and they're struggling with these people often, not rarely. Anyhow, one of the issues, of course, that comes up is, as we've already alluded to, is the hope of discontinuation of therapy. Here are two docs who tried this strategy and it didn't work, and they'd like a little feedback. We'll start with Dr. Buffalino.
He was excited because the drug itself was causing him a lot of fatigue. So he was eager to see if he could come off and stay off of the medication. So we initiated the discontinuation trial and followed his BCR-ABLE testing quite closely. And unfortunately, just in 3 months, he lost his MR3. That was repeated and confirmed a month later, which was sort of a frustrating thing, knowing that he was sort of an MR4 for 2 years. I guess my question is, what are our indications for a successful discontinuation trial in CML? He's actually now on dasatinib. Have people had more success on the second generation drugs in discontinuation versus the first generation drugs in discontinuation trials?
I have so far had two occasions. One was on imatinib, the other one was on dasatinib. In both cases, I have tried to hold therapy, and in both cases, roughly about 3 to 4 months in, I've had to resume therapy. So in our experts' experience, what is their experience?
So any thoughts about discontinuation? And again, is there any difference in the success rate with the second generation agents? What's your experience?
Yeah, so this, so I have, you know, a lot of experience. I probably have about 40 or 50 patients who have attempted discontinuation over my years. I find this to be a very important topic and one that I see a lot of patients in consultation. I'll take a step back a little bit and say, I don't know that it matters who gets to MR4, MR4.5 with what agent. About half the patients will recur. You're more likely to get a deeper remission, all things being equal, with a second generation TKI than you are with imatinib. But once you get there, the ability to stay off therapy is about the same. Even though the EuroSCI study looked at MR4 discontinuation, is I typically wait for a complete molecular remission before I will discontinue a patient. And so a 4.5, you know, really undetectable. That patients have low risk disease. They have low risk disease and you're measuring it. You know, it's going to come back at some point. Although oftentimes in this particular case, it was only 3 months. It's usually a lot longer of a window. I will use this strategy if I have a young woman who wants to get pregnant because I can keep her off drug for a period of time. I will use this strategy if a patient unfortunately develops another comorbidity and needs to stay off for a surgery or a cancer therapy. But in general, I will try to keep the patient on until they're in a CMR, which is 4.5. The other strategy that I've often used more recently is lowering the dose. So imatinib, if they're at 400, take the dose down to 300 and see if you see an uptick in the BCR-ABL. If you do, then you know that discontinuation is not going to work, as opposed to just, you know, stopping it cold turkey. But it's important to know that low-risk patients, low SOCL risk patients at diagnosis tend to, and who achieve a CMR have a better chance of staying off therapy than high-risk patients who achieve a CMR. Disease biology matters, probably matters much more than the simple drug that got you there. And the other thing that's important that I think people don't pay attention is the duration of CMR or MR4, if you want to use that as a boundary. The longer you're on therapy, the better your chances. So all of the studies required you to have disease for 3 years on therapy and to be 2 years in an MR4 or MR4.5, depending on the study. But all of the studies showed that if you were treated for 4 years or 5 years, that your chances of staying off therapy increased. So in with that light, I often will bring the dose down, you know, for a year before I stop. And that gives me a little bit of a trick. So because the patient wants to be successful when he or she stops. And that's something. This particular patient was having fatigue. So sometimes lowering the dose and watching may be an answer. If the BCR-ABL goes up, then you know that discontinuation is not going to work. And if discontinuation is the goal, I don't know if it should be the goal for every patient, but if it's the goal for this particular patient, maybe trying a different drug and then trying, which is what is the case now, if patient's doing well on dasatinib.
You mentioned the issue of conception and pregnancy. Do you stop TKIs in men who wish to, you know, have a child?
Yeah, so we wrote that out of the NCCN guidelines a few years ago. We no longer require or recommend that men, as my wife always reminds me, men always have it easier than women. C'est la vie. But we no longer recommend that men discontinue or have a holiday for TKI discontinuation. That it's you know, you're free to procreate, if you will. But it's very important that at least during the first and second trimester of pregnancy, that imatinib or other TKIs be avoided because there is this early fetal loss. You can safely restart the TKI during the third trimester, although I do try to hold off until the child's delivered. But you can safely restart during the third trimester.
So let's talk a little bit about monitoring the disease. I thought this is, again, as I've been chatting with medical oncologists, seems very problematic in a number of patients. Not everybody sort of goes very simply the way that first case does. So let's start out with another patient, Dr. Grunwald, who's a 40-year-old man. And actually, here are his numbers, and he's going to talk about this verbally, but just we plotted it out so you could sort of see what happened. But in any event, this is a patient who didn't achieve the treatment milestones of MR3 at the time that he was hoped. It was hoped it would have happened at 18 months, and here's the case.
40-year-old male diagnosed with CML and initiated on dasatinib 100 milligrams daily, tolerating dasatinib well. Noted to have missed the milestone for major molecular response, either the 12-month or 18-month milestone, depending on how we want to look at it, for being less than 0.1% of the BCR-ABL. But this patient's really, really, really close, and he's tolerating the dasatinib well. So what do we do? The patient wanted to stick with dasatinib, and I thought it was very reasonable because there was no trend that the BCR-ABL was rising, and it was low, and the patient had no symptoms and normal blood counts. It took until 2 years, but the patient was less than 0.1% at the 2-year mark, And the patient has just achieved a deeper and deeper remission over time and now is many years out from starting therapy and is in MR4 or MR4.5. So has had a great and sustained response to dasatinib. It just took a little bit longer than it takes most people.
Any thoughts?
I love this case. This is very important because when I see patients, I often see this reflex hammer of, oh, the patient is suboptimal. I don't know what suboptimal means. And we're going to increase because we have to target 0.1. But let's take a step back and remember what these numbers mean. So cytogenetic remission means that if you do a bone marrow, you don't see any Philadelphia metaphases. And that's equal approximately to a BCR-ABL of 1%. And cytogenetic remission or BCR-ABL of 1% is what's associated with overall survival. Deeper remissions improve rates of progression. So there's always that few patients that'll progress. And so the deeper you go, the less likely you're going to have that individual, right? You're talking about macroeconomics, microeconomics. An individual is going to have a lower risk of progression. But from a group study, achieving a cytogenic remission or BCR-ABL 1% is associated with a normal life expectancy. That's what I impress upon my patients. And as long as the trend is going in the right direction, I don't make any changes as long as the patient's tolerating the medication well. And I think this is a beautiful highlight. Patient just took a little bit longer. And the patient did achieve, you know, his milestone without increasing efficacy. All too often, I see patients having their drugs altered to a different agent and then dealing with toxicity with that agent where they weren't with the first agent, or dose intensifying the first drug and then getting some toxicities. I have example after example after example. I think this is a fabulous opportunity to really focus on what really matters and what's the goal of therapy. The goal of therapy is for the patient to have a normal life expectancy and not to progress. And as long as close follow-up and compliance was being done and monitored, you can see this patient just took a little bit longer to meet his goals. Now, if the goal is, you know, in an 18-year-old young woman to have a baby in a certain window, that may alter your goal. But in this particular 40-year-old man, really the goal is survival. And congratulations to Dr. Grunwald, who did a fantastic job. I love that case.
I love that case too. Here's another one that's interesting. 82-year-old man with CML is a patient of Dr. Pezwani. This patient actually started out on imatinib, had thrombocytopenia, GI bleed, ended up on nilotinib, 150 BID. Unfortunately, a month after the nilotinib was started, admitted to the hospital, shortened of the breath, pleural effusion, congestive heart failure, ejection fraction 35 to 40%. 82-year-old man also. Stopped nilotinib, and the patient started to progress. Here's the case.
82 years old, came to Dallas to live with his daughter because it was becoming harder for him to live by himself. It was thought that if he had a biventricular pacing device that he could potentially have better cardiac function and potentially have improvement in his shortness of breath and his heart failure. And once that was done, I was able to convince him to go back on nilotinib.
So I see he tolerated 150 milligrams a day, but is progressing now. No resistance mutations. Now what?
I told him that given his age and given his other comorbidities, maybe going up on the nilotinib may not be the best idea. And maybe achieving MRD or a major molecular response may not be our goal, but just if his IST is less than one, that we could just keep him on the same dose and see how he's doing because he's tolerating the medication really well at this point.
And his IST right now is 0.8. You know, I guess there's no way to know whether nilotinib contributed to the CHF. This man's 82 years old, and maybe the cardiac disease is going to be a big problem for him. Any thoughts about this case? Get the feeling of she doesn't want to rock the boat right now.
Yeah, no, I think this highlights the last point that I made on the case from before. And she brought up the same point I made is, you know, really achieving cytogenic remission with a BCR-ABL of 1% or less in this particular individual is, in my opinion, a very adequate goal. I always fear using nilotinib because of, you know, the incidence in this age group of cardiovascular disease. It's unlikely that it contributed to his cardiomyopathy, the reduction in his ejection fraction, although there are some studies. But there is a risk of thrombosis and ischemic cardiomyopathy. So, you know, one has to make sure that that's not going on. And I agree with you. I would probably be reluctant to increase the dose. Given the heart failure, dasatinib may not be the optimal choice. Bosutinib would be an option. And of course, the drug that we started with, asciminib. But I would probably watch this individual a little bit longer and see where the pace of the disease is going and what the other comorbidities are doing, and if I can stabilize the patient before moving on. But I think that's a good point. You know, this 1%, what should be the goal for the patient? Every patient is a little bit different.
So I'll talk about some cases of relapse disease. We have a couple of cases here, beginning with a 28-year-old woman with CML who's had multiple TKIs and still with progressive disease, also issues with compliance. Here's the case from Dr. Patel.
She was given first-line therapy with dasatinib for 6 months and had a good hematologic response. However, ended up relapsing, then switched to dasatinib at 300 milligrams twice daily, along with hydroxyurea by the prior provider. Counts had again improved, but within 2 months, she again relapsed, ended up having relapse within 2 months with worsening splenomegaly, and was again seen by a transplant center, but was non-compliant with the follow-ups. No new mutations, was then switched to bosutinib, 400 milligrams daily, again had no improvement, and was now switched to ponatinib. So at what point would the experts recommend to refer patients to a transplant center, especially for someone that's so young at 28 years old?
Any questions you have in general about CML?
Where does omecetaxin fit into the picture?
Any comments?
So a couple of comments. I think the first one is the question that was addressed is, when would you refer a patient to a stem cell center? I do so with a third line therapy. I have all my patients. I like to know what the status is for transplant, whether there's a donor. This case highlights compliance. If a patient's not going to be compliant with their TKI, they're not going to be compliant post-transplant, so our transplanters won't transplant somebody who has a history of non-compliance unless that can change. But to answer the question, whenever I prescribe a third line agent, I always like to have the transplant team, not because I'm going to transplant, but because I want to know what my options are. I always like to have an ace in the back pocket. Is there a donor? If there's not a donor, how are we going to look for it? It's going to change my strategy depending on what's available for that patient. The patient kind of toggled through all of the known TKIs, was on ponatinib, and still, you know, having some issues. I'm not a huge fan of omecetaxin just because it can control the counts, but it doesn't induce a lot of molecular remissions, which are associated with, you know, long-term survival. So this would be a perfect patient to consider asciminib, that one agent that we talked about. This patient had gone through all the ATP mimetic agents, you know, whether compliance was an issue or true resistance, doesn't have a resistance mutation, which is important to document. And 80 milligrams once a day or 40 milligrams twice a day would be the dose of asciminib. And I would at least give that a chance. I would ask the transplant physicians to meet with her just so I would know what the HLA typing is. But geez, if she's not going to be compliant, then that's going to be an issue.
So I should mention that, you know, we started doing these webinars in, I guess, April 2020. I never imagined it would go so smoothly without technological. We've done hundreds of webinars. We are having some technical problems for a while. We couldn't get our chat room working. Now it's up and running. So I got a couple questions for the chat room. We lost my audio video a little bit earlier, but just amazing how rarely we have problems. Anyhow, Anita has a 65-year-old patient who's progressing on nilotinib, now in blast phase with transformation to ALL, 70% blast in the marrow, 2% in the peripheral blood. Any thoughts? First diagnosed in 2016. Of course, there's just a few pieces of information there. Any general thoughts about that?
Yeah, so the vast majority, it's an unfortunate case, but a great case. And the vast majority of patients who progress from chronic phase to blast phase often will acquire a T315I. So it's very important to look for that. What's the best way of looking through it? You know, whether it's Sanger sequencing or NGS sequencing, I think both are available depending on the institution. We do both here, but that's what I would do. I would think about ponatinib. The patient went from nilotinib, progressed, now is in blast phase. I would think about ponatinib, single agent ponatinib, although can be efficacious. I'd be thinking about combining it with other agents, depending on the patient's comorbidities. They are 65, either combining it with chemotherapy, steroids, or even some of the immunotherapies like blinatumomab or inotuzumab, and thinking about transplant. The goal of therapy is to get the patient back into chronic phase and then transplant the patient, assuming that, he or she, I forget what the sex was, he or she is transplant eligible, 65 they should be. But ponatinib, make sure there's, see what the 315I is, and then, you know, question about adding additional chemotherapy on as a bridge to transplant. But this is a not very common sequela of therapy nowadays, but it does happen.
So actually, Anita adds in there, after listening to you, no mutations present, but he has a G250G mutation. You know what that is? I mean,
yeah, that's part of the P loop, and it does cause resistance to some of the second generation TKIs. So that may be the mode of resistance. And it does open the possibility of using another second generation TKI if ponatinib is contraindicated because of comorbidities. So again, the power of sequencing, the power of always looking for an ABL kinase domain mutation, because, you know, the algorithm that is typical, imatinib second generation, which one, and then third generation ponatinib, you may go a little different way if you have a resistance mutation against one second generation, but is sensitive to another second generation. You know, so that does open the pathway. So that is the reason why this particular patient developed resistance. Most common is T315I, but you can't exclude all the others.
So I like to brag that we have the best chat room in the business. And now that it's working, it's just blowing up with great cases and questions. We won't even be able to get through all of them. But Dr. McKenna, actually, she was on the program with Dr. Cortez and presented a patient who she initially gave imatinib to in 2004, and she's still treating the patient. And she had brought up the issue of long-term cardiac health in patients on imatinib, also osteoporosis. Any data on that? She also wants to know, what about using higher dose imatinib and higher SOCAL score patients when the other drugs are not available or accessible?
So all of those are, yeah, all of those are great ideas. So there was some reports about cardiomyopathy early on as reduction, dilated cardiomyopathy with imatinib. The clinical trials just haven't demonstrated that. We required a lot of the trials to do echocardiograms, and we really haven't seen that. The biggest toxicity that we see long-term, which is a dose and duration effect with imatinib, is development of chronic kidney disease. So subtle elevations in the creatinine. Although, again, it could be hypertension. It could be a variety of issues. Imatinib, you do see that. And that may be, that's one of the reasons why I tend to lower the dose of imatinib as patients get older, or if I see a rise in the creatinine. In terms of, you know, increasing the dose of imatinib versus second generation TKIs. I mean, that used to be the trend that we used to do. It does acquiesce more toxicity to the imatinib. I have a very few patients that are on 600 or higher doses of imatinib. I typically, my clinical practice would be to switch, but it's not wrong, especially if a patient's tolerating it well, or if there's a financial issue as to why that patient should be on imatinib. I think the data is a little bit stronger in terms of achieving a molecular response with second generation as opposed to increasing the dose from 400 to 600 or 400 to 800 of imatinib. So that would be my preference always, but there are always exceptions to the rule.
So I think I have a question that probably nobody's ever asked you. Well, let's see. How do you dose a TKI for first-line CML chronic phase in someone with bariatric surgery?
same way. There's no change. There doesn't seem to be a change in the BMI. So in a patient, you know, as they're losing weight, you don't have to dose ramp up or dose adjust. You're going to use your correlative studies to see how well the patient's responding. You know, the issue may be in terms of dasatinib, which does require an acid environment to be absorbed. That may not be right. the best choice for this individual. Although, depending on how much, whether this was a banding study or whether it was a, you know, a diverting, depending on what type of surgery happened. And that's where your discussion with the surgeon is very helpful. And whether the patient's on a proton pump inhibitor or not, you know, that may tend you towards or away from dasatinib. But, you know, weight and BMI doesn't seem to influence the dosing schedule.
So sometimes I have to just read these chat questions and hope that you understand it, because I don't necessarily follow it exactly. So here's a question or case from Dr. Kumar. I have a patient who is MR 4.5, but out of the three different transcript, P210, B3A2, P210, you can see the rest of them, persistently detected, fluctuating between 0.04 to 0.08. What is the significance of these other transcripts?
Well, they're all different start sites. So the BCR-ABL, it depends on which of the introns is where that's landing. And so you have three different BCR-ABL sizes that you need to look at, the P190 and the P210. And then the P210 is two different start sites. Some patients will express one. Some people will express the other. And some people will express both, about 10%. And you need to sum them. We used to report them independently in our institution. Now we sum them so that there's just a total P210. You don't have to do the math in your head. And so this particular issue, it's important. It's part of the disease. And so there's two different splicing variants for the P210. And, you know, it's about 45-45, depending on which one is expressed. But about 10% of people will express both. And they need to be summed. It's actually a spectacular question.
So Dr. Jacob wants to know, how do you manage lymphoid blast crisis of CML differently? Do you manage it differently than myeloid blast crisis? So I'm going to let you answer that after you see this next case, a 41-year-old woman from Dr. Grunwald.
Weeks after the six-month check, the patient presents to the emergency room with recurrent left upper quadrant pain accompanied by nausea and vomiting. White blood cell count is 28,000 with 20% blasts. Bone marrow examination confirms blast phase CML with 54% blasts and BCR-ABL 523%. The patient's blasts are noted to be lymphoid and are positive for CD20. Lumbar puncture is performed and the patient's noted to have CNS involvement by her leukemia. This patient received an ALL regimen because this was lymphoid blast crisis, plus a TKI. We thought a hyper-CVAD-based combination therapy would be most suitable. That is what we used. And we used rituximab because of the CD20 positivity. And we also used a TKI, ponatinib in this case, which I'll frequently use in blast phase CML for patients who've received previous TKIs and been resistant. And this patient achieved remission and ultimately underwent hematopoietic cell transplantation and has done well.
Any thoughts?
This is a great case and was expertly managed. So secondary blast crisis is different from primary or de novo blast crisis. They tend to be a little bit more resistant. I agree with Dr. Grunwald. I usually use ponatinib-based therapy. It's important to think about, very similar to the case that we had a little while ago where the patient progressed on nilotinib. This is a patient progressing on dasatinib and has lymphoid blast crisis, which essentially needs to be treated like acute lymphoblastic leukemia. And remembering that CNS involvement that can happen in about 10 to 15% of these cases, and that needs to be adequately prophylaxed and treated, as was in this case. So we'll usually use some type of combinatorial therapy. I typically will reach for a ponatinib as a third generation TKI with some combination therapy. Hypercevat is as good as it comes. And with the goal of, after adequate CNS prophylaxis, moving on to allogeneic transplant. And then restarting maintenance TKI post-transplant is something that wasn't mentioned, and that really should be part of the standard of care. You had asked a question, Dr. Love, about myeloid blast crisis and how that differs. It's kind of the same theme, though. Less CNS disease, so I don't tend to prophylax there. I typically reserve, add ponatinib, and then I'm looking for an AML regimen. Myeloid blast crisis tends not to respond as well as lymphoid, but the goal there is adequate cytoreduction in allogeneic stem cell transplant. So I'll usually use an AML regimen, 3 and 7 plus ponatinib, FLAG-IDA plus ponatinib. There's a variety of them out there. FLAG-IDA has been reported a little bit more. And then again, after successful transplant, maintenance TKI with ponatinib post-transplant, as long as the counts allow.
Actually, Dr. Grunwald had put that in there. He mentioned he put the patient on the TKI, but I just cut that part to make it shorter because we like try to stick to 1 minute.
Yeah.
Anyhow,
well, I added it.
here are some questions we asked the faculty about the disease progression, second and third line therapy. So we said, in general, you have a patient who gets a major molecular response with imatinib, then has disease progression. What's next? Any thoughts about the faculty answers?
I think we're all in the same, we're all answering it the same way with slight subtle differences. I think we're more similar than not. We're all saying that, when a patient progresses on imatinib, we're all going to choose a second generation. That's what's available. We're not going to move to a third generation yet. Asciminib is also not approved for that. It's going to depend on comorbidities. In general, I typically reach for a once-a-day drug as opposed to a twice-a-day drug. It's more compliant. But a lot of it's going to depend on the comorbidities. Does the patient have pulmonary issues? Does the patient have GE reflux disease? I may not use dasatinib on that. Does a patient have a history of thrombosis or ischemic cardiomyopathy? I'm probably not going to use nilotinib on that. Are there some hepatic insufficiency or some liver function abnormalities that the patient has due to whatever comorbidities? Bosutinib may not be my choice. So I think that, you have three excellent options and you try and pick the drug to the patient.
And what about second line therapy on a patient who gets second generation TKI first line?
Yeah, so, trying to read into the label, some of my colleagues, went straight to ponatinib. It is true that going from one second generation to another second generation has less efficacy. But if there's no mutation, I will typically will try a second generation before moving to ponatinib or asciminib. And the reason for that is to keep it on label because these things are approved third line. I think using ponatinib as second line is not unreasonable, but asciminib is only approved third line.
So let's see if we can squeeze in one more case here. Another patient of Dr. Grunwald, 75-year-old woman with CMR, with CML, who gets a MMR on nilotinib, but then develops a peripheral arterial occlusion 9 years later. Here's the case.
75-year-old female with coronary artery disease and chronic phase CML, who's been in complete molecular remission on nilotinib for nearly 9 years and develops claudication in the right lower extremity. She's found to have a peripheral arterial occlusion requiring a stent. What are the cardiovascular risks associated with nilotinib, and what treatment strategies are available to this patient? So for this patient, we actually, because the remission had been so deep for so long, we said, well, why don't we first try to pursue TFR, treatment-free remission, just see if it comes back. If it doesn't come back, then we're done. We'll just keep monitoring you. If it does come back, we'll switch you to a different agent. And so this patient, we stopped. Unfortunately, within a month, we saw a little bit of BCR-ABL positivity. And with that, we said, okay, well, do we go back on nilotinib or do we switch to a different one? We chose to go to bosutinib.
So what's your current status?
So this patient is doing well in bosutinib and has again achieved a complete molecular remission.
Any thoughts?
Yeah, no, this is a, you know, all these drugs have side effects, and nilotinib has increased risk of thrombosis and some ischemic cardiomyopathy, as mentioned earlier in some of the other cases. And so I would not put her back on nilotinib. I would avoid ponatinib if we weren't done that. I think either dasatinib or bosutinib. Bosutinib not having the pleural effusion issues makes a lot of sense, as long as there's no hepatic or diarrhea. I think it's perfectly makes complete sense. And you have to know what the toxicities are of these agents. I probably would have been a little bit more aggressive in terms of stopping the nilotinib earlier in a patient with a molecular response, 75 years old, or reducing the dose. But, you know, that's unclear whether that would have had any effect.
Interesting. So, Dan, thank you so much for joining us today. I love talking about CML. I wish all of oncology was like CML, maybe someday. Anyhow, audience, thank you for attending. Come on back next Tuesday. Speaking of targeted therapy, we'll see what Dr. Liu has to say about the many forms of targeted therapy of non-small cell in addition to EGFR. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Thank you.